Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Nimrod Conference for Readers and Writers takes place tomorrow at the Alan Chapman Activity Center with readings and panel discussions by poets and writers, including the judges and winners of the journal's annual awards, along with invited guests, one of whom is my guest today. John Katz is the author of 23 books of fiction, nonfiction, memoir, children's books, and short stories, but he's best known for his stories and books about dogs and of stories of Bedlam Farm, an upstate New York home for his dogs, donkeys, and sheep. Katz is a former reporter and news producer. He's written for Slate, Rolling Stone, New York Magazine, Wired, and Slashdot. And his best-selling books include A Soul of a Dog, Izzy and Lenore, Dog Days, A Good Dog, and The Dogs of Bedlam Farm. His newest book, which is due out next month, is titled The Second Chance Dog, A Love Story, which tells the story of his new wife Maria's overprotective dog, a Rottweiler Shepherd mix named Frida, and how the romance with Maria was somewhat predicated on wooing Frida as well. Katz is the author of the blog BedlamFarm.com, and he'll be speaking about memoir and blogging at the Nimrod Conference tomorrow, as well as reading his own work. John Katz is my guest today on Studio Tulsa. John Katz, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me here.
You were a journalist, and then you were, as I think you put it, a quiet novelist for a while before you started writing about dogs. But I assume the changing point was when you had this sort of midlife break where you said, I got to get out of the city, and you moved.
Delicately put.
Yes. And wrote about it in Running to the Mountain. And, of course, there was a good bit about your dogs there. And all of a sudden, I assume that's what really sparked this whole thing.
Well, no,
I'll tell you the
great truth about that. I decided, just as I was heading for 50, to think about my life. People call this a midlife crisis when men do it. When other people do it, they call it a spiritual revolution. Whatever men think about their lives, they're having a midlife crisis. But I guess it's as good a name as any. And I was thinking, okay, how do I want to spend the rest of my life? So I went and bought a little ratty cabin in upstate New York. I was living in New Jersey at the time. And went up there, and I had two dogs who kept me company. They were only incidental in that book. They were really more a Thomas Merton kind of inspired book. And I read Thomas Merton, and he was my guide for thinking about things. I just did a lot of noodling up there. My first night there, I woke up, and there was a cow looking in the window. And I ran and called 911. And the sheriff answered. He said, well, yes. I said, there's a cow looking in my window. And he said, well, where are you from? He said, and I'm from New Jersey. And he said, well, is the cow menacing you? And I said, I don't know. In New Jersey, that would be an unusual thing. So he said, well, why don't you give him a few hours? She'll probably go back home, which she did. But anyway, I wrote this book, I Run to the Mountain, and I thought about my life. And it was back and forth and back and forth. And then later, some years later, because of that book, someone sent me a ranged border collie from Texas and thought that it would be a good dog for me. And I, of course, should not have had a border collie at that point, especially in New Jersey. So I was having these great adventures. I took him sheep herding and was trying to work things out with him and figure him out and realized I knew nothing about dogs like that. And I started taking him up to the cabin upstate New York. There's a wonderful woman named Margaret Waterston, a Quaker who runs a bookstore up there, ran a bookstore. Very direct, very straight talking. And at the time, I was working on a book about technology for Random House. And I was in talking to Margaret one day, and she said, you know, John, I have to be honest with you. The stories you're telling me about the dog are a lot more interesting than the books you write. And this really shocked me, but I also thought it was true. The truth of it is at home. And it was a great adventure getting this dog and learning about him and trying to make it work with him. So I didn't finish the book I was working on. I just wrote that book off the contract and sent it in. And then I was shocked to learn this great thing about writing. If you write books about dogs, people come to your meetings. That was amazing. I had many lonely readings for years. And suddenly there were long lines of people waiting to see me and wanting me to meet their dogs and talk to me.
Now, okay, you're writing technology books and crime novels. All of a sudden you send in this story about a dog. What was the reaction?
I think there was relief, actually.
Something sellable.
Well, I think they were shocked. It was a shocking thing, but it also was a funny story. I had done all kinds of – I started as writing novels. My first novel appeared the day the first Gulf War broke out. It sank like the Lusitania. And then I just started doing mysteries. I was really looking to explore men. And really, I wasn't interested in the mysteries so much as what I was seeing in suburban life. The rise of the boomer child culture, this great confusion among women as to whether they should be home or not be home or working. Many women in that community there couldn't find a comfortable place to be. If they were working, they felt guilty. If they weren't working, they felt diminished. And then the men sort of started coming home, and that didn't work because nobody could make any money. And then the nannies arrived, and that didn't work. So there's this constant searching among the boomers for the right place. I didn't really like any of it. I had a daughter, and I found the boomer culture was just disturbing to me. The, you know, not letting kids have their own problems and micromanaging their lives and living in fear. Every week my daughter would have another class and being afraid of something.
Be afraid of strangers. Be afraid to go out and play.
Be afraid to talk to strangers. Yeah. Be afraid to play. Be afraid of drinking. Be afraid of sex. Be afraid of everything. And it was not a dangerous town. Nothing happened to anybody. So I was increasingly uncomfortable living there in that culture. So when I had the chance, and I was always looking for what to write about, I never really liked writing about mysteries. I just found the structure was too confining. You had to basically write the same book every year. And if you changed it, people didn't like it. I got really sick of the character itself. It was boring. So and it didn't sell that much either. And then the dog thing, I'm sort of not in the mainstream when it comes to the dog thing either. It's my gift, really. It's not figuring out how to be in the mainstream. Because a lot about the dog culture makes me very uncomfortable.
What makes you uncomfortable about
it? I just think the emotionalizing of dogs, the personifying, the anthropomorphizing of them, it's over the top. It's gone off the deep end. You know, the best-selling dog book in the world is The Rainbow Bridge, where when you look at this and deconstruct it, nobody knows who wrote it. It's by far the best-selling dog book. And the idea of it is when your dogs die, they go over this bridge and wait for you. And when you die, you go over the bridge and you meet them there. And you and your dogs spell all of eternity throwing balls at each other and running around. And I think to myself,
that's a nice story, but we could turn to worm dirt, too.
We could do that. But also, I say to people all the time, that's a nightmare. I don't want to cross the bridge and find six border collies and three labs waiting for me for all eternity. You know, not for their sake or my sake. Let them go chase sheep, you know, for all eternity and let me alone. So I think there's a tremendous amount of projecting on dogs. I love dogs, by the way. I should make that clear. I'm crazy about my dogs. But I think people have just lost perspective about it. You know, they don't think like us. They're not our babies. They're not our fur babies. They're not our children. They're not our best friends. And there's so much pressure on them. There's like 400,000 dogs in America on Prozac right now for separation anxiety and depression. And we're making them crazy just like we are by thinking they're just like us. So I find, you know, that's also kept me from exploding to the top of the dog world because I make people a little bit uncomfortable with that. They don't want to hear that. You know, they're animals. They're wonderful animals, and I like to respect that about them. And they become a hugely important part of my life, aside from what I write about. But what I really love writing about dogs, and the reason I've stayed with it, is it's a great chance to write about people because anybody who talks about their dog is telling you about themselves. You know, I did the new work of dogs. I spent a year at the University of Kentucky studying attachment theory. Why do people like certain dogs? Why do they feel about them the way they do? So, and I also went upstate. I bought this farm because I wanted to have a sort of laboratory to live with animals and learn about them. So I'm on the, you know, the country is split into different groups. There are people who have pets, people who have animals. In a place like Oklahoma, people understand animals. They understand pets too, but they
probably have both. Yeah, mostly, both. I mean, you'll have animals and pets.
But in the East or in the West, they just have pets. Mm-hmm. So every animal is a pet to them. If you go to rural areas or suburban areas or even upstate New York where I live, people understand animals and they understand pets. But the two worlds are not speaking to each other. So I feel like I'm right in the middle because my animals are a cross between pets and animals. You live on a farm, you don't do a lot of emotionalizing for too long. You know, there's no such thing as a no-kill farm.
Right.
You know, and there's a lot of life and death there. But there's a great tension among my readers too. If you know, I had to put down a pony who was blind and he was struggling through a winter and I put him down. And my guy's like a war criminal. People were just, how could you do that? There's this idea people love animals so much. I think it used to be that, you know, the great philosophers like Socrates and all worshipped the human spirit, the human soul. I think we're disappointed in humans these days, so we're beginning to worship animals. And if you live with them, you love them.
That's kind of a major step backwards.
It's a major step backwards. Well, I think it is a major step backwards. People tell me all the time their animals are like their children. Their animals, mm-hmm. They love animals more than people. You know, that's new terrain to think about, I think. It makes me uncomfortable.
My guest today is John Katz. He's the author of over 20 books of fiction, nonfiction, memoir, short stories, and children's books. His newest book is forthcoming called The Second Chance Dog, A Love Story. And he'll be speaking at Nimrod's Conference for Readers and Writers tomorrow at the University of Tulsa. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. yet while we've had this discussion, you know, when you look at your writing, there's these wonderful stories. And as we were talking there, I thought of two. One is the viral story from going home the perfect day. You know, this is a story of an owner whose dog is dying and says, I'm going to give this dog the perfect day. And I get choked up even thinking about it. It's beautiful writing, by the way.
Thank you.
But the other one had to do with this story on your farm of this somewhat confused Labrador, I think it was Lab, and a neutered ram.
Yes, Lenore. Yes, right. That's the children's book.
Yes, right. But yeah. I assume there's some truth to it?
It's all true. I have pictures of all of it. My lab puppy, Lenore, struck up a friendship with a ram, Brutus, who had been neutered but was very much a ram. And I had the border collie, Rose, who was taking care of the sheep, who was just absolutely shocked and horrified at this. And,
oh, yeah. It's, you know, getting back to Babe or something like
right,
that.
Right.
It's like, you know,
you don't become friends with the ram. And she tried to break it up relentlessly. And she would chase Lenore away, and Lenore would come skulking home and chase the ram away. And they kept finding each other. It's one of those unaccountable things that happens with animals. They just loved each other. And Lenore would pop up out of the woods and find Brutus. That was his name. And they would graze together. They would sit together. He would look for her, and they would nuzzle each other. Rose would go nuts. And so eventually they wore her out. This was a love that could not be denied. And this is why I got the farm, because this stuff happens all the time. And eventually Rose just ignored them. She decided, okay, she was disgusted. And I thought she was going to resign. I thought she was going to show up with a briefcase and say, I'm out of here. So it was great to see it. I have all these great, wonderful pictures of it. I'm fortunate to have pictures of it. Of the two of them, and Lenore started eating grass. She would eat grass together with him, and they would just lie down and sit in the sun and take naps together. It was quite a lovely thing. He died, and she's gone on to other things. But she's one of those dogs that, like Labs, are that love everything. They just are all about love. Mm-hmm. They're a really wonderful animal. I think they're just one of the great family pets of all time, of Labs. But again, you know, as with all the animals I've had, you need to understand them as animals and show them how to be calm and show them how to be appropriate and give them work to do. It's a lot of work having a dog. It's not a simple thing to do it properly.
I was remembering something you wrote about a couple of Labs when you first moved up to the farm, where they understood when the Macintosh went on and the little droom,
yep,
until it went off, they had to be quiet. And I just can't imagine every Labrador I've ever met or seen. I don't own a Lab, but I have friends that do. They seem like they couldn't sit still for nothing.
Well, you know, I think I have had a lot of Labs and a lot of border collies. I've never had a dog that ever moved while I was writing, ever.
Wow.
Just yesterday, I have a barn cat who was attacked by something, and we had to have her leg amputated.
Oh, gosh.
This is one of those great animal decisions. It's a $2,000 decision. It's a barn cat, right?
Right.
My farmer friends look at me like, are you out of your mind? You know, we don't spend $2,000 on a barn cat. But my wife and I are very attached to her. And if you'd asked me a month ago, would I spend $2,000, I would have said no. And of course, we did it. And so she's in the house. She's never been in a house. And she's got a hood on, and her leg stump is healing and all. And I have a Lab in the house, a Rottweiler, a Shepherd, Frida, and Red, the border collie, my new dog from Ireland. And so it's a border collie, a Rottweiler, Shepherd mix on a Lab in my room where I'm writing. And a cat comes in, plumps down on the dog's bed, and all of them go to sleep. And I put a picture of it up on my website. And they're all sitting there. And I believe very strongly that they become what we need them to be if we allow it and expect it and train them to do that. Labs are made crazy by people because they teach them everything but how to be calm and how to be and do nothing. Labs were bred for hundreds of years to be quiet with people. That's what they were created for. They sit with hunters for days.
Right. And you can't move until you're told to move.
That's in them. But it's never developed because people don't want to train them. They throw balls at them all day and crank them up and give them food and wrestle with them. I see it all the time and take them to dog playgroups where they run around and get crazier. And, you know, people forget about dogs. Dogs are killing machines, all of them. They're killing machines. They all come from wolves. They have a lot of prey drive. And the hunting dogs, especially the working dogs, really need to be shown that it's okay to do nothing. When I'm working, I have a real dignity issue in my mind. I don't have dogs. I'm working. And I ask them to respect that, and they do. I've never had a dog that didn't do that. And I think it's really a part of mental attitude, a part of the catastrophe of training in America that, you know, these expensive books that teach people how to do nothing. You know, I was reading E.B. White, who wrote beautifully about dogs, and he wrote about housebreaking. It made a big impression on me. He said his grandfather said, if you want to housebreak a dog, you just separate them from the house for a couple of days. That's it. And that's, you put them in the barn or in the basement, and then they're housebroken. It's true. It's absolutely true.
So they go outside. They say, this is the place where I do
my
business.
They don't go in the house anymore. And I've done that with all my dogs. It just works like it. Never had a problem with it. Or a crate will do the same thing, really. Mm-hmm. But the simplicity of that, that, you know, people didn't used to need $40 training books to housebreak a dog. I mean, the farmers all knew how to do it. It's the same thing with having dogs work with you. Labs are dogs that were literally bred for hundreds of years to be quiet around people and be patient with them. So that's in them. And when we have these crazy labs running around, it's our fault because we haven't bothered to think through how to show them what they're really meant to be, as well as give them plenty of chances to run around. I mean, when my labs are outside, they're disgusting. They're just running around. I wouldn't even tell you what they do. And that's fine. You know, let them be dogs. But in the house, my working is important to me, and I wouldn't put up with it.
I want to ask, we've talked around Bedlam Farm. This is where you live. It's in upstate New York. It's a beautiful, beautiful site. I assume it's in the Adirondacks. Is it in the Adirondacks?
No, it's still just in the south Catskill? Of the Adirondacks. Uh-huh. Last year, we moved to a smaller Bedlam Farm.
Mm, I see.
17-acre one. But it's still Bedlam Farm. And it's about an hour and a half north, right up by the Vermont border. It's way up there.
Yeah.
Not all the way up there. Upstate New York is just vast.
Yes, it is. Yeah, beautiful country. Now, at one point, you're running sheep. I don't know if you're still running
sheep. We have
sheep.
I have
donkeys?
We have three donkeys. I have a sheep and a new dog, Red. It's going to be a book, I guarantee it. I got an email from a woman in Virginia. She said she had read one of my dogs, Izzy and Lenore, about my hospice dog. And she said, I have a dog I took off a farm in Ireland. He was being mistreated. I brought him to Virginia. He's a great herding dog. He's a great working dog. And God spoke to me and said, he has to be your dog. So now this made me kind of nervous because
yes.
Usually God is not involved in my dog acquisitions. And I thought, what if it doesn't work? You know, that's like going to be bad. So I thought she was crazy, to be honest. And she was sending me emails. She didn't seem crazy. She seemed really thoughtful and knowledgeable. A very established breeder. She was just determined that this was going to be my dog. So we got to talking, and then it turned out I remembered having met her at some herding trial, liked her quite a bit. We started talking on the phone. We became quite good friends. She's a minister, and I realized just because someone's religious doesn't mean they're crazy. maybe it's a good thing. And I really liked her, and she said, look, God spoke to me. I wouldn't take any money for the dog. You just have to have him. My dream for him is perhaps he can be a therapy dog one day. He was beaten up on a farm in Northern Ireland. I've rehabilitated him. He's a little crazy, like all border collies are. So a friend of mine was going through Virginia. She brought him up. And Karen Thompson, who gave me the dog, was correct. He's just a wonderful, wonderful dog. He herds the sheep every day, and he's become a therapy dog. We're working with vets from Iraq and Afghanistan. So he's the new presence on the farm. I've had him about 8 or 9 months, and we're inseparable. He's a great, great dog. And that's a great lesson for me, too, to be open. You know, I have a donkey, Simon, who was taken off a farm by the New York State Police. They charged the farmer with animal neglect. Terrible shape, just about dead. A real sweetheart. He loves people. Where I become one of those strange men who wander around talking to donkeys. You know, a lot of books about men. I become one of them.
Yeah. What I wanted to ask you about Bedlam Farm is, certainly, you've written a lot about how this has changed your life. How's it changed your riding life? I mean, from what I can see from, you know, you were a very dedicated writer and journalist for a number of years, but has it changed your riding life at all?
Yes. You know, I've written since I was 8. I've always wanted to be a writer, and I started sending letters to the Providence Journal when I was 8 years old, complaining about traffic and Red China and the UN and stuff. So I've always had the itch to write and always done the writing. I think the running to the mountain began a long process for me, a spiritual process, an awakening process. You know, there's this idea in America that if you get a farm, you're going to have a perfect and idyllic life. People around here know better than that.
Yeah.
A farm is rough. And I had a rough time there. I cracked up there. I got divorced, a 35-year marriage ended up there. And I started going to pieces there. So I'm a big fan of Joseph Campbell and the hero journey, you know, and the you set out on the hero journey, and you may find what you want. You may not find what you want, and you may not return. Along the way, he writes, you may encounter magical helpers, often in the form of animals. And I feel like that's what happened to me. I feel like I needed looking for something. I was living in a town called Hebron, a kind of place you would go if you never wanted to meet anyone. And there, right across the street, was the woman I fell in love with and married, Maria. And that was what I was looking for. I think that's what I was looking for. So there was this, a lot of these forces. I also had a powerful experiences with these animals. You know, Rose, the border collie, and I were alone there for several years through these apocalyptic New York blizzards and stuff, where you kind of find out what you're about. So it was a mixed thing. It was a very painful, disturbing, and frightening thing, which I almost did not survive. And it was the most wonderful thing, which kind of saved my life and gave it focus. I have this theory about men and men writers, that the only male writers I really like were either tortured as children or humiliated as adults. And I think I was both. So
yeah, you were. Well, so, you've written about that.
But it opens you up. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, going there is a process of opening me up to new experience.
You wrote a poem recently about this that's on your blog. I actually printed up some of those poems.
You did. Thank you.
And that kind of talks about what you just were talking about, this idea of, you know, finding the new home and what that's meant to you.
You mean this one?
Could you read that for me?
I've never been asked to read a poem before. I'm very excited. See, I'm up here being surrounded by all these poets.
And, right.
And they just want me to meet their dogs. It's like, okay. I once lived in a dank house of confusion and pain with a divine old dog who tried to scratch his back on the stars. I could barely breathe there. But then I met my lover. We started laughing and singing all night and making love. The house of confusion and pain turned ugly and scared the old dog and threatened me. You better stop that loving and laughing and singing all night, or I will fall on you and smother you with dust. I ran to the old and smelly dog, the fleas scattered in a cloud. I picked him up. My lover grabbed some clothes. We rushed out the door just before the walls collapsed. There was a huge cloud of dust. We live in a new house now, a bright old house with no name, but big windows and tall ceilings, a big bed for the divine old dog to sleep on. At night, the house whispers to me, I love you. You will always be safe here. And the house said, I love the way you smile. Fear, I answered, sinks the boat. It makes me a little tingly.
Well, that's great. And you write poetry quite a bit on your blog.
It's the strangest thing. A couple of years ago, it's funny, I do it in the strangest way. I'm almost embarrassed to describe it. I sit there at night, I light a candle by the computer, I sit by my Apple monitor. The dogs always gather around me in a heap, and they've always done that with me, and go to sleep. And then they just come out. I don't think about it. I don't work on it. I don't rewrite them. I don't look at them
again. So that was the first draft?
First draft, just exactly as I thought it. And I deliberately don't even go back and look at them. Because I don't see myself as a poet, really. And I don't know what happens to them. I think this idea of one of the themes I think I do come out is this idea of being brave enough to find love. You know, one of the themes in my new book, one of the themes I'm writing about a lot, I call creative aging. You know, in America, the story of older people is the story of downsizing and long-term health insurance and IRAs and talking to your friendly doctor about Viagra.
Or the other side of it, which is I'm not going to age and I'm going to do everything
right,
to preserve
totally
myself.
I'm not getting older. I'm not going to do it. You know, I don't have one of those friendly doctors you see on television. My doctor's like this angry Polish woman. She doesn't want to talk about my penis. She says if it's working, as long as I'm peeing, she doesn't want to talk about it. And I don't want to talk about it either. And I don't want to take pills to stimulate my love life either. But this idea, you know, I don't have long-term health insurance. I don't have IRAs. I don't have any money in the bank. And it's a trap because there's no security. You can't buy security in this country or any country. And you can't trade, in my mind, your whole life for that illusion of security. I saw this guy on TV talking about long-term insurance. And he said, well, the only people who can afford it are rich people. And by the time you need it, the costs have gone up so much it doesn't work anymore. So don't bother. But I don't want to make that trade-off of, you know, I was 58 when I bought the farm, never set foot on a farm, and in my 61 when I found love. And I just wouldn't trade that for anything. You know, if I had gone the secure route, I have this friend of mine in New Jersey who called me up and very excited. He said, I'm downsizing. I said, what do you mean? I'm buying a condo in Jersey City and selling my house. I said, why? He said, because I don't want to take care of lawns anymore. I said, you've never taken care of lawns. You've always hired people from other countries to do your lawn. And your lawn is the size of a carpet to begin with. And he had this idea, this is what he has to do. So he's moving into this two-room apartment, and that's his life. And I'm going the other way. I think you don't have to buy a farm. You know, you don't have to be that extreme. But for me, I think it was an affirmation of life, not a denial of it. You know, I know where I am. You know, I'm not a kid anymore, and my knees tell me where I am every morning. And I understand that. I respect that. But I think this whole process of exploration and experience, you know, it's to me like it's like a death to buy into that fear machine. You know, what do you ever see about older people in America ever that isn't grim? You know, and it's just like the whole system is conspiring to make us think we can live forever and then blame us because we can't afford it.
It's like the story of a band. It always ends badly.
So you're off, but you don't have to buy into that story. It's really, I think, one of the main reasons I went to the farm. You don't have to buy that story. You know, you can write your own story, which is a realism and understanding where you are and being open and honest about it. But you don't have to give up on life. It's actually a wonderful, you know, I'm so much better at being older than I ever was at being young. I was no good at being young. I'm getting better at it. You know, you learn a few things. You can pass a few things on. I started to do some teaching. I'm doing some mentoring. So I love my life, and I'm not going to make it into a misery. But I think the poems are somehow popping up out of that.
One last question. We're about out of time, but I want to talk about your new book, which is The Second Chance Dog, A Love Story. And this is about the new love in your life, your partner, right, Maria, and the story of her dog and how you really almost had to court the dog as more than Maria.
Frida, we call Frida the hell dog. I call her the hell dog. She's a Rottweiler Shepherd mix. She was abandoned in the Adirondacks where she lived for 5 years on her own.
Wow.
And Frida's a lot of dog. And Frida goes after something. She usually brings it home. Children, bicycles, whatever. She'll go into the woods and come up with a raccoon. And
wow.
She caught a deer last year. She was sitting on it. I know. I came out of the house and she's sitting on a deer. She didn't hurt it. She just was sitting on it. The thing was shaking. I said, get off that deer. I call her the dog who kept men away. And her mission was to kill me.
Yeah.
Keep me away from Maria. So we had a whole year of drama where I call it the beef jerky campaign. We go into the barn, throw beef jerky, and run. We worked it out. She guards my study now, and nobody bothers me. She's a great dog, and it's a great story because I think Maria. I knew Maria wasn't coming without the dog, so I had to figure the dog out. And Maria came to trust me because of that. It really opened the door to our relationship. So I'm very grateful to Frida. It's tough times. I think but that was by far my greatest training challenge. We're going to open the book tour in a couple of weeks, and she's coming to my reading.
Oh.
We'll see what happens. It could be exciting. Eat a few readers.
Yeah.
She never hurt anybody.
Well, we wish you great success
with
that.
Thank you. It's great talking with you.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Writer John Katz speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His forthcoming book, due out next month, is titled The Second Chance Dog, A Love Story. And he'll be one of many guests as a part of the Nimrod Annual Conference for Readers and Writers, which takes place tomorrow at the University of Tulsa in the Alan Chapman Activity Center. For more details on the conference, visit their website at utulsa.edu/Nimrod. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.